I realize that Christmas Day is now past, but the story of Christ's birth was not completed in the manger at Bethlehem. In fact, if you look at the nativity sets that are traditional, there's some characters we haven't even talked about yet. They're, of course, the wise men or the magi. Now, I realize that in most of our nativity scenes, we have the wise men there along with the shepherds at the manger, worshiping the Christ child. We know that they actually came later. Some of your more conscientious folks will actually put the wise men a little bit away from the manger, showing that they were coming. Matthew tells us in the second chapter of his gospel, verse 11, about the wise men when they finally found the Christ child on coming to the house. Notice, not the stable. On coming to the house, they saw the child. That's a different Greek word there than baby or newborn. It's a little bit older of a child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. And they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, incense, and myrrh. That's the familiar story. That's the part we know. That's the part that we sing in our Christmas carols. Even though the traditional "We Three Kings of Orient Are" is probably wrong in three senses. We don't know that there were three. The Bible never tells us how many wise men there were. We just assume that because there were three gifts. They certainly were not kings. The magi of those days would have been the advisors. In some sense, the scientists of the day. They were very well respected, but they were not kings in that sense. And most of us, when we think of the Orient, we think Far East, right? We think Japan, China, Korea, that area of the world. That's not where they came from. Scholars believe it was more of the Middle East. Many believe they came from Persia, modern-day Iraq or Iran. I personally believe they came from the land of Sheba, which is in southern Saudi Arabia, but that's for another Sunday to discuss. But what happens next is what I'd like to focus on. Verse 12 ends with a very ominous note. Having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. If you'll recall, when the wise men first came to Jerusalem and they're asking, where is this newborn king of the Jews? We've seen his star in the sky and we've come to worship him. Of course, that caught the attention of Herod, the king of the Jews at that time, the king of Judea. He was an old man at this point. He had married several wives, all of whom gave sons who were looking to succeed dear old dad. He had gotten paranoid to the point that he had put some of his sons to death on suspicion of treason, had his favorite wife put to death, for which he later regretted. It was a mess during that time. And so Herod brought in the wise men and he said, look, you search out and find this child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I may worship him too. I think back then if they had air quotes, he would have said, worship him, because that's not at all what he had in mind. He wanted to worship him with a sword through his belly or something. But the wise men are told, don't go back. And what we see is that no sooner was the Christ child born than dangerous threats arise. And this is very much in keeping with all of biblical history. Think back all the way to the fall when Adam and Eve first sinned. God told the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. That enmity you see throughout time. How often did Satan try to anticipate what God was going to do and snuff it out before it even happened? Remember when Moses was born? Satan must have known that God was going to do something, rise up a deliverer. And so he worked through Pharaoh to have all the Hebrew boy babies thrown into the Nile. And we see later on in our passage a similar threat happening. Satan's always trying to get ahead of God, but as we know, he always fails. Kind of like the Wile E. Coyote of the spiritual realm. He's always trying. He's got all these schemes and all these plans, and they always backfire. They always come back on him. But from the very beginning, when Jesus is still a helpless baby, you see threats to his very life. Now, what unfolds is, as we wrap up our series of the first Christmas angels, I'm calling the angel and the protective parent. Once again, we see Joseph stepping up, fulfilling his role in protecting his young family and listening to the voice of the angel. And I think there's a great lesson for us to learn from his example. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 13 details a revelation of unconscionable savagery. The wise men have come and gone. They had been warned not to go back to Herod. We don't know if an angel was involved in that. Matthew doesn't say. But he does identify an angel in the next warning. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." Here is this theme of hostility that arises, that really casts a shadow over the whole life of Jesus. The angel first tells Joseph to get up. Now, the original Greek here could mean wake up. It meant that in chapter 1, verse 24, after the angel had spoken to Joseph, he got up and did what the angel had told him to do. Here, it's more of an imperative. Get up. Get up now. There's a sense of urgency here. Joseph is told to take the child and his mother and seek safety. You notice how many times, you're going to see it, I think three times in our text here today, whenever Jesus and Mary are mentioned together, it's always the child mentioned first. Usually we would say mother and child, right? But the order is significant. You take the child and his mother. When the wise men came, they found the child and his mother, and they worshiped him, not them. Matthew's always very clear about that. Now the angel says, "Go to Egypt until I tell you it's safe to come back." Why Egypt? Egypt, they're always the bad guys, right? We remember Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments. The Egyptians are the bad guys. Why in the world would you go to Egypt? Well, for one, Egypt was outside the reach of Herod the Great. Wasn't in his jurisdiction. Remember, the whole area was under the government of Rome, but they had areas of sovereignty or areas of jurisdiction, and Herod did not have any power in Egypt. He could not send his soldiers down there. And given where they were, if you look at a map of the Holy Land, Jerusalem and Bethlehem are on the southern part of Palestine. Egypt was closer than to try to go north out of the region of Herod or to try to go east. Not only that, there were a lot of Jews living in Egypt at that time. In Alexandria, which was the largest city of Egypt in that era, there were more Jews living in Alexandria, Egypt, than there were in Jerusalem. Some have estimated up to 1 million Jews lived in that city. It comprised 40% of that Egyptian city were Jewish. So there would have been plenty of countrymen to have accepted them. They wouldn't be completely strangers in a foreign land. with lots of maybe not folks they knew, but certainly they share a background. They share language. There would have been a familiarity there. Now, this has become known as the flight to Egypt. I'm always reminded of a story about a Sunday school class, and it was right around Christmas time. And the teacher had told the children, draw a picture of the Christmas story to take home to your parents. And so a lot of the children are drawing the manger scene. I'm sure they're probably thinking of the nativity scenes they've seen. And there's, the shepherds and the sheep and maybe an angel and, of course, Mary and Joseph and Jesus and all that. But there's Billy. And Billy draws a picture of an airplane. And the teacher says, Billy, this is supposed to be a picture about the Christmas story. And Billy looks up and says, it is. It's the flight to Egypt. Teacher says, okay, I notice you have four people in your plane. Who are they? She says, well, there's Joseph and Mary and Jesus. She says, well, who's the fourth? And he says, well, that's Pontius, the pilot. Okay, maybe he didn't get the story quite right. But you know, this is one of those parts of the Christmas story that not that many people know about. Now, I'm kind of impressed that he put all that together myself. Now, the angel has told Joseph, get up, get your family, go to Egypt. And in verses 14 and 15, we see his reaction. And it was a reaction of unselfish shielding. It says, so he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. So it was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Without a moment's hesitation, Joseph obeyed the word of the Lord. He didn't lay there and say, man, I got to stop eating so late at night. These dreams are killing me. He didn't say, nah, maybe I ought to sleep on it. You know, I'll get up in the morning and it'll be fine. Immediately, he gets up. You know, he tells Mary, we got to go. We got to go now. Where are we going? We got to go to Egypt. Egypt? Are you kidding me? No, we got to go. An angel told me, we got to go. So in the middle of the night, they pack up probably the very few things that they would have had. But remember, the wise men had just left, so they did have some expensive gifts. Bundled up on their poor donkey. I mean, he's still trying to recover from coming from Nazareth. You know, now we're going to go to Egypt, which would have been more than twice that distance. But immediately, he got up. And he went. At no point do you hear Joseph muttering, this ain't even my kid. He took that responsibility, and when he was told, he obeyed. I think that's a great lesson for us. The New Testament does not tell us about the route they took, but the regular caravan trail from Bethlehem led south, down along the road to Hebron, went sharply west toward Gaza. Yes, it's the same Gaza you hear about in the national news from time to time. And they would have gone along the Mediterranean coast down until they got into Egypt. If they averaged 20 miles a day, which was typical at that time, it would have taken them about 10 days to make it to Egypt. Now you think, how could such a poor, displaced family afford such a trip? I mean, they didn't have anything when they came to Bethlehem. And this is where I believe the gifts of the wise men came in. We never hear any more about the gold, the incense, and the myrrh. I mean, what happened to those things? Do you think Mary and Joseph put them on the mantle and looked at them all the time? No. I believe they sold them in order to make this trip. Now, if Joseph had been one of us, you know, he might have said, wow, these gifts would make a nice down payment on a house. Or, I've got my eye on some carpenter's tools down at the hardware store. This might work out pretty well. Or maybe even saying we need to set up a college fund for Jesus. No. He was very unselfish. And he said, this is what the family needs. And whatever it took, he provided. Now, meanwhile, back in Bethlehem, we read, when Herod realized he had been outwitted by the wise men, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill all the baby boys in Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time that he learned from the wise men. Remember, when they came, he said, when did you see that star appear? And they told him, about 2 years ago. Now, some have said that meant Jesus was 2 years old when this took place. Not necessarily. The star did not necessarily appear when Jesus was born. It may have appeared before his birth because they had to travel a long distance. But Herod's not taking any chances here. So any child, any baby boy in Bethlehem and its vicinity, born in the last 2 years, put him to death. And he sent his soldiers out, and these children were killed. Once again, Matthew cites an Old Testament prophecy, this one from Jeremiah. A voice is heard in Ramah. Ramah was the Old Testament name. In the New Testament, that town was called Arimathea. You might remember Joseph of Arimathea, same town. Weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Matthew sees every step in Jesus' life as a fulfillment of the Scriptures. Now, some of them make us kind of wonder a little bit. That first one out of Hosea, out of Egypt, I called my son. Really? It's under the influence of the Holy Spirit. The Spirit was guiding him to make these connections that we might not make. But it shows that everything that happened didn't happen by accident. At no point was God not in control. This was all part of the divine plan. Now, some scholars and commentators discount this story of the slaughter of children in Bethlehem because it doesn't appear anywhere else. Only one of the four Gospels attests to it. None of the ancient historians, such as Josephus, who is a Jewish historian of the first century, don't even mention it, even though he gives us quite a biography of Herod the Great. Part of the problem is we're too influenced by Hollywood. You ever notice when Hollywood does the scene, they go up and down all these streets and every house has four or five boy babies 2 years old and under, ready for slaughter. The truth of the matter is the little town of Bethlehem probably had no more than 1,000 people in it. Some have even thought it was about 300. So think Kinney. That's about the size of Bethlehem. You're not going to have dozens of boy babies able to be killed. In fact, it may have been 10, 20 at the most. You say, well, that's still horrible. And yes, it is. It's still an atrocity. Unfortunately, in the life of Herod the Great, that doesn't make the cut. He was so brutal that, a handful of boy babies in the little town of Bethlehem, no, it probably would not have made the headlines. Sad to say. Doesn't mean that it didn't happen, because this fits perfectly with what we do know of Herod in his final days and the brutality that was right up to the very end. The Bible doesn't tell us how long they stayed in Egypt, but we do know historically that Herod the Great died in 4 BC. I realize that takes a little bit of explaining, because if he died 4 years before Christ, how could he be part of the story? Well, the fellow that came up with the AD and BC plan missed it by about 5 years. Jesus was actually born about 5 BC when you use the years. So their stay in Egypt was probably brief. May have been a few weeks, may have been a few months. I doubt that it was years. But they were there, they were safe. And in verse 19, the angel reappears to Joseph. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and head for the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." Now, this instruction is almost word for word what he had heard before. Get up, take the child and his mother, and go. Now, instead of going to Egypt, they're going to Judea, going back to their homeland. Every step is under divine direction. This wasn't Joseph's idea. He didn't get up and say, "You know what? I really think maybe we ought to head back home now." He waited for God to move. He waited for God's direction. Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes, "Day after day, Joseph awaited the divine command to return home. He didn't take this decision himself. He waited upon God's wisdom. And then God sent the command in a dream to stand up, go home with the child and his mother. Why? Because those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." Here, the mighty Herod is dead without achieving his purpose, but Jesus lives. And that's always the way it works. Satan tries his best to thwart God's plan, and he always fails. Herod thought he could keep his throne by killing all of the children. And certainly that newborn king of the Jews would be one of the casualties. But in the end, it was Herod who was dead, and Jesus lived. And I would suggest that part of the reason why you can say that is because Joseph was faithful and obedient. When the angel of the Lord came and said, "Go," he went. He didn't argue, he didn't complain, he didn't hesitate, he didn't think about it, he did it. Mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Joseph does not say one word in the New Testament account. You never hear him speak, but his actions say a lot. And his actions were always obedience to the Lord's direction, and his obedience was immediate. When God said it, he immediately did it. Even when it wasn't in his own best interest. He took Mary and this child who wasn't his into his home, even though that may have cost him his reputation. He may not have really wanted to take a pregnant wife on that trip from Nazareth to Bethlehem, but he did. I'm sure he didn't want to get up in the middle of the night and head off for Egypt, but he did. Once they got to Egypt, he might have gotten kind of comfortable. You know, it's not so bad down here. A little bit further south, you don't get so cold as they do up there in Galilee. But God said it's time to go back, and he did. Every step of the way, you see his unhesitating obedience. He immediately gets up and goes. Now, when they return to their homeland, an unhappy surprise was awaiting them. When Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Yes, Herod was dead, but his kingdom was divided up among three of his surviving sons. And one in particular named Archelaus was put in charge of Judea, which would have included Jerusalem, Bethlehem, that whole area. And he was every bit as brutal as his father. One of his first acts as king was to kill 3,000 Jews that had stood up and protest of some of the things that father had done. Just put them to death. He was known to be cruel in an age when cruelty was common. Even amongst all those that were terrible, his name rose to the top of that list. And in less than 10 years, Rome decided they were done with him. They banished him off to some far-off island in Gaul, and in his place put in the Roman governors. Some 30 years later, a guy named Pontius Pilate would be the governor of Judea rather than the king. So, where is Joseph going to take his family? Once again, having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee and he went to live in the town called Nazareth. Now, Luke tells us that's where Mary was from. We don't know if Joseph was from there or not. We know his lineage linked him back to Bethlehem. I've got a feeling that's where Joseph wanted to settle. After all, that's where Jesus was born. And Bethlehem's a much nicer town than Nazareth. I mean, really? Nazareth? Matthew finishes this section by saying, "So was fulfilled what's said through the prophets, he'll be called a Nazarene." And that has made scholars scratch their head for centuries. What prophecy is he talking about? There's nowhere that says that the Messiah would be a Nazarene. I mean, the city of Nazareth doesn't even appear in the Old Testament. It doesn't appear anywhere. It wasn't even a blip on a map. And a lot of attention has been called to that one verse. What in the world is Matthew talking about? And I think we tend to miss the point. The point of this story is Joseph's obedience. He's the hero here. It's not about Herod. It's not about Archelaus. It's not about the wise men. The point of the story isn't how many baby boys were killed or where in Egypt the Holy Family fled or what obscure prophecy is Matthew talking about here. The point of the story is Joseph's selfless and at times even sacrificial commitment to his young family and his obedience to the word of the Lord. Dietrich Bonhoeffer concludes, "Should the word of God be fulfilled and made known to us, we must obey it. And if needed, we should be prepared to rise in the night to do so." Joseph did just that. What about us? Now, I'm not suggesting that you go home and take a nap this afternoon, some angel's going to appear and tell you what to do. But we have God's word. We have the scriptures. And the Spirit of God will take that word and speak to us very individually. And there are times when he's going to say, "This is what I want you to do." What are we going to do? We're going to think about it? We're going to rationalize about it? We're going to weigh our options and say, I don't know if this makes a lot of sense. And financially, I don't know about this. What are my friends going to do? How's this going to impact my career? Or are we going to say, "Yes, Lord. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it"? I really believe that's the lesson of this story. I really believe that is the example Joseph sets for us. We say we trust God. Will we trust and obey when we hear his direction on our lives? Joseph is not known for anything that he said. I'm not suggesting he was mute. I'm just saying that's not what he was known for. But what he's known for is what he did. And his actions spoke much louder than any words ever could have. And that is an example I think we can all aspire to be.